Hey, Steve Wolf here. Welcome back to the Fire Break, sponsored by Team Wildfire, developing innovative technology and tactics for putting out tomorrow's most dangerous fires. And I'm here today with amazing Jennifer Gray Thompson. Jennifer is well known to many people in the fire community through her own podcast and writing, but probably most dearly known in the community to all of the people that she's helped host fire. She runs a program called After the Fire. This is based on the premise, I imagine, that most people aren't experts at having had their towns burned down because, you know, typically it doesn't happen that often. And when it does, they don't know what to do. So Jennifer sends teams of volunteers in there who have experience in helping communities recover from fires and, you know, kind of shows them the ropes, holds their hand and gives them a hug. I hope you give them a hug. Is that part of it, Jennifer?
I love that part of it. Yeah, it's a very big, important part of it.
So tell me, how did you get started in this journey? What attracted you to this passion in your life?
Well, you know, I'd never had a moment's thought about wildfire, and I'd certainly never heard the term megafires before October 8th, 2017, and my life has not been the same since at all. So I live in Sonoma Valley, and okay. At that time, we had this massive megafire that broke out over four counties. It's a complex fire, the largest of which was the Tubbs Fire, which most people are familiar with. You know, I worked for the county at the time for a supervisor, and so I had an extra responsibility. I live in a part of Sonoma Valley that's actually pretty isolated from the rest of it. We do border Napa, one of the other counties affected. And so I just started working, 20 hours a day, working really hard. It was a very terrifying experience, but it was also the most incredible human experience of my life. So coming out of that, and I grew up here, so it was also a hometown thing, you know, to see so much damage and destruction and pain. I said, you know, I want my life to be about helping my region rebuild, not knowing that we were really just opening up the era of constant megafires and a very different time. And we thought that it would just be this area. But then as soon as the Camp Fire came and the Woolsey Fire, it all changed from there and we became national. So that's how I got started.
Yes. So what a personal experience, right? And There's no substitute for having personally been involved in something like that to really inspire you. And what I really love about what you did is that you took a solution that you developed for your community, and then you figured out how to replicate that aid to other communities. Can you tell me about some of the other fire victim communities that you've aided and what type of restorative help you give them?
Sure. You know, one of the things that is always governs exactly how we work is what did we learn in our fires? You know, how did we want people to come in? How did we guard against fraud? There's so much fraud after disaster. And then who was there who actually understood what we were going through? And because it was unprecedented, there was really nobody. There's a little bit of Lake County from the 2015 Valley Fire, but they were also heavily affected by our fires. So I really just took those basic lessons of really reverse engineering, asking what do you need and how can we help, as opposed to layering what I was willing to do over a fire community. What I learned from the Camp Fire people and the Woolsey Fire is that knitting us together in order to really help them jump ahead, to skip that 13 months of painful lessons, you know, paying it forward was not only really helpful from a practical point of view, but to bring along some hope. A lot of these communities are just so, all of them are just so struck down by what has happened, and to show them and bring them people who have actually made it out the other side. That's one of the things that we do. You know, since then I've worked in, I don't even know, maybe 18 counties across four states. The Camp Fire, Woolsey Fire, CZU Lightning Complex Fire, a little bit of Thomas Fire. We were a little overwhelmed though, so that came much later. Santiam Canyon in Oregon, Alameda Fire in Oregon, Marshall Fire, Colorado, and of course now we're in Maui, and I'm leaving again for our second deployment on Saturday for a week, and I'm bringing some mental health experts this time.
And that's to go to Hawaii?
Yeah, you know, Maui is really a masterclass in how to recover from a megafire. It's very complicated. They have a legacy of colonialism, which does complicate it. And then it's on an island, housing crisis. So certain elements we've seen before, but you know, there's a lot of things we haven't. They have pre-existing water issues. They have coastal erosion. So there's a lot going on here. And they also have what we've never seen before, such high land values with such low incomes. And so I've made a commitment to be there every other month for the next year and bring them people who have navigated this or are experts in their subject areas, all the way from national programs like the CDBG-DR Block Grant Program or FEMA IA, you know, all the way to fire survivors who are between 2 and 6 years post-disaster. So, you know, I will look and I will listen and I will hear what they want. And then I try to deliver what it is that I'm hearing. And I try not to assume that I know until I hear from the people. We've actually gotten a really great reception at all levels. We make sure we're not just doing the senators and the governor and all those things, but we're really looking at from the ground up. What are the frontline people experiencing? And then we help them lead and design their own local recovery. We do not supplant them or try to take resources from them.
I see. So how do you get into the conversation there? Because I imagine that when you show up somewhere, there's already somebody who thinks that they're in charge, right? Whether local government, FEMA, somebody thinks they're in charge and that everyone else, you know, works for them or takes orders from them. Whereas you are actually, you know, you're the patient advocate here. Right. So how do you get into the conversation, and then how do you help the other authorities, you know, steer the help in a way that's most beneficial to the victims?
Well, you know, because we're a survivor community, we do get sort of an extra inroad that would be difficult for other people to permeate. And it really depends. Like sometimes, like the Dixie Fire, we were asked to come in within 4 days of Greenville burning down. But sometimes, like the Maui Fire, we waited. We knew that a lot of people were going to rush in. There was a lot of attention. There was a huge amount of tragedy. And so I evaluated it daily to see what would be the right time for us to come in, that we would add value and not be in the way. That was just a very important thing with Maui in particular. I usually start pretty much right away. Senator Hirono's, Mazie Hirono's office reached out to us within 48 hours on the recommendation of Senator Feinstein's office. We start talking to their lawmakers at all levels. And then it is true that, like, getting the community leaders, both emergent and official, getting the mayor's office, the county, you know, on board to really be able to hear us and to understand that we're for real. And that's a very hard thing to do after a disaster. I'm very patient and I really do understand where they're coming from. We've had the ick too. We've had people come in and try to sell us basements in Sonoma, California. So we know that there's a huge amount of, for lack of a better term, you know, people who maybe have good intentions and they get the dopamine hit, but they do a lot of promises that they can't fulfill. So that's a rule, is we'll always fulfill it. So I start delivering before we ever hit the ground. And I also make sure that I come in through multiple points of entry. I learned the hard way that if you go in through one point of entry and they're not trusted by the community, then you become associated with that person.
I see.
So I really go through a multitude of people. And, you know, because we're pretty well known in the wildfire community at this point, a lot of people then recommend us and they feel comfortable that they know we're going to be super, we're going to have a lot of integrity and compassion, intention, and we're going to fulfill all of our promises, which is not that usual. If we can't do it, we never say that we can.
That's an amazing way to build integrity. I know that you provide these, you know, services to communities on a, you know, kind of a pro bono 501c3 basis. How do you get funded? Who are the nice people who make your work possible?
Oh, that is such a good question. It's, you know, I'm a terrible capitalist and I wish that I was better at that. It's just not my, I worked for the government before and I was a teacher for 10 years before that. So you can imagine it's not my comfort zone. So what I do is that I do have good relationships with organizations like Fannie Mae. I do scope of work for them. They often come into communities with me. They have a remarkable disaster program. They've had it for about 6.5 years. They showed up in our disaster. I was a little confused. And then once I understood, you know, their leverage or what they could do, it really did help us hugely. In the case of Maui, I start looking around. You know, we started this organization with $2 million. So we were able, it was PG&E funded it. It was unrestricted. And that was very nice of them, but we really concentrated those funds locally. And so everything that I've done after that, I've had to go out and really ask a lot of people for it to please support us, donate, you know, corporate donations. Plus we have a wildfire leadership summit every year here in Sonoma. It's national. And we bring together top wildfire leaders to talk about innovations and what's it like to be a frontline community, best practices.
Yes.
So those are through sponsorships. It's really, it's not my favorite thing. And I'm working on that. I need to get better at it, but it's usually through, I advise a company or something like that. That's what I do. But or I ask just for this, like for this deployment we're going on Saturday, I did get funding from a national nonprofit for this work in particular. So I'm always out looking for more money. Yeah.
Right. Sending the photograph of the child, right?
Or the fire.
Here's the individuals that you're going to help and the community that you're going to help. So tell me about the scope of the program. When you come in, you know, what are the services that you offer, and based on the feedback from the communities that you've helped, you know, which are the ones for which they're most appreciative?
You know, the first thing they're most appreciative is to meet people who've been there, done that, and are not being overly prescriptive. We don't allow heroes or saviors. And if people have that idea, then that's the last time they're going to travel with me. That's for sure. And that really hasn't happened a lot because I set the tone in advance.
Yes.
You know, in the listening to what it is that they need and what stage they're at, I have a very deep network of people who are very good in this field, who do everything from public sector. And there's a lot of willingness to pay it forward from every previous community. So when communities say to me, like, what's the cost for this? I say, I'm going to call you in about a year or two. Well, and we're still working together at this point anyway. And then I'm going to say, I need you to come along with me. And that's when they volunteer. And so I am very fortunate to have a strong group of volunteers. You know, disaster survivors always want to go in and mitigate the pain of other people. I have a lot of great public sector relationships with local officials and those entities like in Paradise and in Sonoma County and, you know, even like Ventura County. So many have been willing to help us underwrite this cost, really to pay it forward, because they know that they got the help and they needed it too. So we do local advising. The other thing is that I get a lot of calls over the, especially the first 2 years of disaster, and I'm a safe place to call. Sometimes they're very stressed as leaders. It's very hard to admit you need help, or that maybe it's getting to you. Post-disaster work is really tough. And so I can either be a sounding board for what it is that they need, or I can actually provide them or send them resources in the form of people. Most of what we do is around people, and I can give them adaptable systems like block captains, zone captains, organizing your community. And I'm always really clear that the goal is for them to adapt, not adopt.
Adapt, not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it sounds like you use the Corleone method here, right? I will not charge you anything. But one day I will call you and I will ask for a favor. And whatever it is, you must do it.
Right. I'm like the godmother of mega fires. Okay, I'm going to take that. Yeah. Yeah.
Your new title.
It's a really moving experience for people, though. I think that one of the things that people miss is that sometimes they say to me, like, your job looks so sad. And I say, you know, it's really sad when I see other communities suffer the way that, like, Maui has suffered. And when you see those things happen, especially when you've seen it in your own community where we lost 8,900 homes.
Wow.
And you don't want, and that was our first mega fire. And we had three after that. Not as devastating, but still horrible experience. You don't want that pain to happen. And so, you know, the people who show up though, or in leadership positions, emergent leaders, or they were previous leaders, for the most part, they're just wonderful human beings, and they're really like doing the most important work of their life. I love stepping into that time. I call it the river of human kindness. And it's it's a remarkable experience. And I'm very sad for what happened to them. And I can stand there and look over the ruins of their town like I did with Lahaina last month, for sure. And I can feel it a lot, but I don't make my own feelings. I don't center myself in their disaster ever.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can't help from the same level, right? You have to help from your own centered strength.
You do. And we also know, like, you know, Megafire, I know Megafire, like, it takes a long time to recover. So I'm always keeping in mind, like, what am I hearing? And then what are we going, what's it going to, what might it be like a year from now? What decisions are they making now around their development? What do they want? You know, in Maui, for example, they're doing some really innovative things around conversions of short-term rentals for mid to long-term housing. We expect them to be rebuilt in under 6 years because of the land values. But how do you get people home who have low incomes, and what federal funds and private donor dollars can go into that? And how can they actually do it in a way that's resilient? Because they have multiple perils there. They have tsunamis, earthquakes, you know, fires. And so you want to end up like looking at approaching a lot of much more powerful people than I am and saying, like, how can you help them get the materials they need to rebuild their housing stock for the next 100 years, but through them, not through me.
I see. Okay. So giving them the self-sufficiency, right? They need help. You know, they need your help and a lot of other people's help to get on the ladder, but the goal is for them to build a climate themselves.
Absolutely.
Right. Really as soon important. As possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
You come out of surgery and the doctor says, oh, no, you're walking back to your room. Like, what? It's like,
well, you
right,
know,
as soon as you start walking, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but I bring you a walker. So,
yeah, right. Right.
That's the deal. I put your little tennis balls on, you know, I'll bring you an accessory. But yeah, you know, it's so violating to have a Megafire happen to you. And people,
yes.
You know, are so disturbed by it. And it's so unimaginable until it's happened to you. And then when it does, it is so personal. Everyone, you know, you look at Maui and people are like, oh, I've been to Lahaina. Like millions of people have been there. But at the end of the day, that's a small town. You know, that's a community that's there all the time. And they are going to do the hard work of rebuilding and making decisions about what that's going to look like. There's no more important voice than the local voice, but they can be overrun by much bigger interests unless they have some tools in order to make the next step. Often one of the most important things that we give them is ideas about what the next step looks like. That is a big unknown, even to people who are very high up in government who've never done this before. It's a huge unknown.
And how do you help them build a framework for what that future looks like?
Well, you know, we do as we say, so right now, for example, they're in the phase of debris removal where they've gotten through the EPA, they've gotten through the, first they did, of course, the casualties, then the EPA, then the sifting, and now they're in the debris removal. And I can tell them that to anticipate that once all the debris is gone, there is almost like an unexpected sadness at the same time, because they are still, this is such a long process, and they are in the super trauma phase where the love is in the air. They're all taking care of each other. But it's really settling in right now, almost 6 months post-disaster, how long and hard this is going to be. And so what I say to them is yes. And, you know, here's what's going to come next. You know, the debris will be gone. And then all of a sudden, there's no visual representation of how you feel is no longer there. But you still feel that way inside. And so oddly, every Megafire community I've been through on some level has mourned the loss of their debris because it was such a visual representation. So I advise them that the next thing to do is visual deliverables of progress and hope. Community projects, art, you know, things that can actually like show them that they are not just scraping away the pain of what happened there, but they're actually building on their, you know, next phase, which we call it's the recovery phase. The response phase is just ending now. Now it starts recovery and rebuilding and really important reimagining. And we find that when we talk about the reimagining piece of it, and I learned this with Paradise actually, that I was meeting with the board of Rebuild Paradise. I helped them set up that organization and they were like, we need to get back. We need everything back the way that it was. And I was like, it's just not there. It's not going to be the same. It's never going to be the same. And I'm really sorry for that, but you can reimagine what you would like it to be. It's okay to now say what you loved about your community before and what you want to, you know, keep and what you want to reimagine. And that gives agency to the people on the ground. And that's really what you want to do, is you want to infuse them with tools and hope so that whatever they decide together for their long-term plan, that they have a shot of really achieving that.
You know, Jennifer, it sounds like you have room really for a second title besides, you know, the godmother of megafires. you're kind of like the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross of fire recovery.
Yeah.
Because you've really charted this psychological journey that people are forced to embark upon when they lose their homes and lose their communities. And it sounds like you've really studied what the progress of that emotional journey looks like. And, you know, and here are the walkers that you're going to need, you know, to help you through each stage, you know, before you come to the, you know, acceptance and new life part.
I think that's very interesting, because I think about it in terms of the stages of grief all the time. You know, somebody recently said to me, well, it could almost be like a good thing that it happened. And I'm like, no, I get what you're trying to say, but no, because you would never say if you lost a child or a spouse or your best friend, you'd never be like, well, good thing that happened. That would never occur.
Right. But good came from it, but not, but it wasn't
a
good
but
thing.
But you do have, I'm what they call a tragic optimist. And so I believe that I know bad things are going to happen, but I do believe in humans. And I believe that we can make good things out of it. But sometimes we just need some help to carry ourselves across the way. And my studying of this process has really just been a lot, like 6 years, 6.5 years of constant experience on the front lines, you know, in many different types of communities, everything from frontier to rural to suburban island, and just really looking at and learning all the time. Like I never walk into a community and I don't and come away not having learned some new dimension of what's possible and what kind of barriers too.
I found it interesting. So I started Team Wildfire to build some new technology. We're physically pushing back wildfires with jet engines. And I thought, oh, cool. We have something new to deploy now. And the first thing people would ask were like, well, how do you scale that? You know? And so I wonder the same thing for you, right? You've developed these techniques that work because of the way you work them. How are you going to train the, you know, next generation of people to take the work you've started, to advance it, and then to distribute it more widely where it's going to be needed? Because we know that we're going to see, you know, at least 30% more wildfire, you know, by the middle of the century. So how do you replicate what you're doing and scale it to the increasing scale of the need?
You know, that's such a good question. And it really comes down to the funding issue from before. Capacity is always an issue. And, you know, I am on a mission, not as a cliche, like I am on a tear around this. And I do a lot of policy work at the federal level. I actually have a bill coming up today that will probably be the most impactful thing that I've ever done with and for fire survivors around taxing of wildfire settlements. So I'm trying to do a couple of things. I'm trying to encapsulate our work as much as possible through the podcast, interviews, through talking to people, through the summit is really important to me because it really is like a work product. It's like every time it's a wedding for me because it's bringing all my people together.
Yes.
And then they become each other's people. And that's really what I want. I do have a concern about the longevity and sustainability without significant funding. I would very much like to train somebody or a group of people in order to train the trainers. I know that the people who go with me, that they really understand it, but they have other jobs. And so it certainly is a concern. And when people ask me like, how did you get that job? And I said, no competition.
You made it yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to make it up myself because I saw what was needed. And in the beginning, it was actually met with a lot of suspicion, like what you must be doing this for some like selfish reason. And I'm like, no, I'm actually not. I'm really doing this because I saw a need and I want to make an impact on this world. That's the kind of life that I like. My love language is to be of use. So that's what I'm doing.
But how I do selfish, wanting to remove people's pain.
Well, and you know, I get a lot out of it. Like every time I take fire, you know, survivor to a new community, they heal a little bit more. There's something about showing people that compassion. And I think there's more of that in this world than we are that is advertised. There is more human compassion. But you know, it's a concern, the sustainability and longevity of it. I'm talking to my board about that actually in the next month or so. People don't love to fund long-term fire recovery because it's not that sexy to, like, no one's selfieing out like 3 years into a fire recovery. But I have been adamant that that is how this work needs to go. And so I will do, I've taken one raise in 6 years, you know, like I will do whatever it takes to keep us on the road, keep us moving, and we'll get there. But it certainly is a concern. And I do wish that people understood the landscape of long-term recovery a little bit better and kept, you know, even if you're not donating to me, like choose a disaster and keep looking for opportunities to help them 2, 3, 4, 5 years later.
Yeah. The only thing harder to get funding for than recovery is prevention, right?
Oh, you know, but yes and no, because the government's in that business now. And, you know, I'm always trying to really advocate too for I have a mitigation program I'm currently offloading. It's okay. Funded by Cal Fire, you know, $5 million program. We had to invent it. Cal Fire asked us to do it, called North Bay Forest Improvement Program. They didn't used to be in the business of mitigation. But they are now. And so it's a very successful program. I'm offloading it because I don't have any desire to, I'm not a mitigation person. I believe in it, but we all have lanes and capacity. Innovation is something I really love. And so I can encourage you to just like keep on down the road, because it does get there. I am always pointing out, like, here's a new thing to do, or here, this person's doing this thing. You should go and check them out, or check out their website, or whatever it is. There are really good minds in this space and in the space of mitigation. And, you know, jet engines will take it. You know, great, wonderful. Or, you know, nanotech with their nanotechnology, Mike Francis, like, that's amazing. There are such good minds out there. And I know startups are hard. I get that. But this is essentially a startup, even though it's a nonprofit. The entrepreneurial side is very similar. And you have to believe in your vision and your dream and your ability to make an impact. You will absolutely get to the other side. Unfortunately, it does sometimes take really large scale disasters like Maui for people to pay attention to it even more. But we are going to get there. I'm very optimistic. Mega fire is solvable. And I know that's something that you and I say, you know, and I see that cross messaged often. So we are not trying to hold back the sea in the sky. You know, we can do something here.
We could do that too if we wanted to.
Well, you know, I'm not a sea and sky expert. I am a mega fire expert.
But they exist, right?
Well, they do. There's so many, actually. It's one of our challenges, is that most of the disaster space is really geared towards wind and rain events in the United States. That's what people, like, I would say 90% of all of the resources, talents, conferences, meetings. I cannot count how many national conferences I've been to, and I am the only wildfire person.
Wow.
I'm like that fire
lady.
Not
for long, I hope.
I hope so too. Like, I hope not too, because I wouldn't mind competition. I wouldn't like it if somebody just like wholesale, like took our whole model, but you know, competition for me can be collaboration, and it really,
right.
You know, many hands light work. And so, I'm optimistic. Yeah, I've been asked
the same thing. Like, what about competition from this, that? And my reply is always, there's enough fire for everybody.
Oh my God.
There's enough fire for everybody, and there's more of it coming. And
actually a very big deal to me when people gatekeep to keep other people out of this space.
It's ridiculous.
I'm like, what are you doing? We have such a huge problem here. Like, come on over and let's sit together and tell me about this cool stuff you're doing, and how can I actually support you and send other people? And I also advise a lot of national nonprofits on how to enter into the space of wildfire and how to do it respectfully. If they're not respectful, I don't like that. They're probably going to hear from me. But if they are respectful to the survivors and aren't just, you know, fundraising off of a specific disaster,
right,
when they have zero experience in mega fires, I'm not a fan of that. But otherwise, like, The people that I've seen who are, it's not that common, who really try to elbow everybody else out of this space. I'm like, you're just elbowing yourself into a lonely corner. Like, what's the point of that? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. And I'm sure, you know, that you and I, we focus on what's the problem, right? How can we help people in recovery, or how can we help the people who were charged with, you know, putting this fire out? How can we improve lives? How can we save lives? And there's no shortage, you know, there's you can never have too many people trying to do that.
Ah, you really can't. And because mega fire is a relatively new crisis, like we've had them before, but how we define them now is just so different. It's only like 6.5 years old. So, but yeah. Our impact though, financially, emotionally, destruction, all of those things is really substantial. So we need great minds. We need people to come in and lean into this with us. We need national nonprofits and I really love the private sector in here because their innovation model is so much faster. We need it. And insurance is really probably what's going to push us there. And yes. I know a lot of wonderful people in insurance, but it does move slower than government. And so I'm hoping that some of that changes.
Can you reset? Just as a physicist, I wasn't aware that there was a form of matter that was slower than government. Can you just describe to me how that works?
Oh my God, they are just a very conservative industry. I do applaud them for their work with the IBHS, the Institute for Business and Home Safety. I really love those people on a personal and professional level. They are doing wonderful work. They really care. And if you ever have the opportunity to go there to Richburg, South Carolina, to their facility, I highly recommend it. I feel like you in particular would really love that. An Ember machine, like you'd be very happy there.
The plans for that. It was what a cool rig that was. Yeah.
It's really cool. And
firebrand generator.
Oh my God. And they also, there's so much pride from, you know, the person that you meet that's the janitor all the way up to Roy, who's the CEO. And I really am optimistic for how far they can get. But, you know, the insurance industry is the funder for that. And I would love for them to be, generally speaking, the insurance industry more on the front lines of like really the incentives for.
I'd like to see them more on the front lines, period.
Yeah.
And they should be for their own economic interest, right? Because there's a real financial misalignment in the fire suppression industry. Because the longer it takes to put out the fire, the more money everyone makes, right? The more days of employment the firefighters get, the more unemployment they get, the more, you know, bombing runs they get with the red sludge, right? The more retardant they sell, the more bulldozer days get
higher. But I don't think they want it, though.
I'm not saying that they want it or that there's right, but it is a financial misalignment, and no one's saying, look, we're going to bid this fire, you know, we'll put this fire out for $100 million, and the faster we get it out, the more we make, right? When states are in charge, exactly, because when the states are in charge, like this is just an expense column for them. There's no revenue to be gained from doing it faster or slower. It's just a cost. But it's the insurance companies that really take it in the shorts when it takes a long time to put these fires out, right? They're the ones who end up paying for each subsequent house that is destroyed, each subsequent neighbor. Like this tallies up their bill immensely. So one would think that that insurance companies would want to get into the fire suppression business so that they could have some control over mitigating their loss.
I feel like they are a little bit though, you know, in California, if you have a house over a certain amount of money, mine does not qualify, but my in-laws does. You do get a notice saying, you know, we're going to send out essentially a private firefighters. That's really been controversial, but now it's just really a fact of life.
Right, that's Chubb sending out wildfire defense systems, right?
You see some of that, but I think in the state of California in particular, I really believe the state would love to see an end to this mega fire era. It's really harming our economics, and our health. I don't mean to have a frog in my throat right at that time, but we don't even
know.
Smoke. Right. It's raining out, but we don't even know what it's done to our health. And UC Davis is studying this, but there could be really long-term expenses at the national and statewide level for, you know, what chemicals are in our bodies, what are we doing? It was really good to see in Maui that I've never seen such adherence to PPE, to making sure that it wasn't floating through the air, to the testing. I think they've learned a lot, but I think that Oregon too is caught very much off guard. It's a much smaller state, much smaller budget, but the pain of the citizenry is so massive. And then it's very hard. It takes years to really get back into an economically stable place. That's really hard too. It's a complicated issue.
It's very complicated, and I think we can't fully appreciate what the costs of these mega fires are yet, because we don't know. You know, in Canada, 4,000 people lost their homes that week, you know, but 120 million people were breathing the smoke. So, what's that going to do? You know, asthma, lung cancer, days lost from work.
I think you had the same reaction as me, which is that I was sorry. The Canadian wildfires are very rough. I'm actually going to Canada in about 2.5 weeks to speak for the Canadian Red Cross in that same province. And, it was a little hard to see New York and Washington, D.C. with orange, the apocalypse over them.
Yeah.
There's a side of me, and I think I saw you say the same thing, which was, welcome to our world.
There you go. It's real.
It's terrible.
Now that you're breathing the smoke, now you believe it.
Yeah, it's that bad.
Yeah, so. What do they say? Never let a good disaster go to waste.
Never.
Right. Because it's during that short window of people's attention that you could actually get them to do something. Once they can't, oh my God, they canceled the Yankees game. Wow. We got to do something about this wildfire problem.
Yeah. I've been working on the Hill for 6 years since I started in this position, advocating for megafire survivors and communities and systems, and I'm really hoping they do codify the CDBG-DR grant funds. Senator Schatz of Hawaii is working on that issue in a bipartisan manner with Senator Hyde Smith. I testified for them in December. I do see progress, and I was glad that the Biden-Harris administration actually had the first wildfires briefing in the history of the United States. So I think people are seeing it, and that was before Maui. Unfortunately, I think Maui probably helped us get our tax reform bill, even though we've been working on it for 2 years before that happened, in front of more lawmakers who hadn't really considered that this could be more of a global problem. But they've experienced now the apocalyptic sky, so it does change it.
I don't want to give away any passwords to my accounts, but my favorite movie was The Right Stuff. And they said, you know, what makes rockets go up? You know, money, right? No bucks, no Buck Rogers, right? And it really is investment of money, both in recovery, in invention and innovation, in, you know, distribution of these answers. I was reading Forbes magazine a couple of months ago, and I saw an article by Phil Knight, who's the founder of Nike. And, and he said, you know, I've got billions of bucks here. I'd rather that it go to good causes than go to the IRS when I die. And I think the greatest problem Oregon is facing is that we're burning our state down and we don't know what to do it. We're breathing the smoke. We're losing our views. I wonder, what do you think is the place of, you know, billionaires and other people who have a little more money than they can spend in their lifetime in allocating resources towards this problem?
Oh, I love that question. Well, they should be giving me some of those resources. I would love your family office to show up on my doorstep. Thank you. You know, here's what I would like to see. And really, I think we should begin in Maui. I would like it to be essentially a world fair of recovery and rebuilding materials, systems, and to be ready for the next fire too. I would like to see their housing stock come back in a way that they are incredibly climate resilient, but it's a showcase for the rest of the globe on what is possible and what we should do. They should be investing in that idea. Cause if you have, you need a place like Maui, there are a lot, you know, millions of people go there, but this is also justice for the people on the ground, the fire victims. This says, get back to your home and be safe. And we're going to institute these really innovative systems, jet engines, whatever it takes, in order to make sure that you are not only home in a temperature controlled environment, but it's also beautiful. You know, yes. So many people think if, oh, I'm going to be wildfire safe, so it should be, so I'm going, I have to suffer in order to have a beautiful, you know, a climate resilient house, unless I'm very wealthy. And this is just nonsense. So I would love to see that all that workforce housing in particular in Lahaina be rebuilt, showcasing these really incredible inventions. I would like to see an architecture that is culturally appropriate, that is very respectful for the native population there, because they have a saying, which I really love, which is what's good for Hawaiians is good for everyone. And I think that's really actually they're on to something there. And I would like to see a lot of investment in these new technologies, these new resiliencies. It's exciting. This is,
it is
funding from the federal government. So I want them to be a partner of the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. There is funding out there, the CEDARS Act. But more importantly, private funding is what's going to really get us over to the other side. So I wish they would scan and look and start to really like hold, you know, VC competitions. What's going on here? What's out there? What's possible? Because it's entirely possible. We are not sitting ducks for this type of disaster at all.
And, you know, and it's quite possible that one type of disaster might provide the fodder for fixing the other one. Because I was thinking about what you're saying about rebuilding the homes. Well, we hope that they're going to be rebuilt, you know, out of non-flammable materials that are highly insulative, that provide, you know, good climate control and don't burn. Lava. You cannot burn lava. It's pre-burned. It comes out of the earth. It's full of bubbles, which provide great insulative properties. And you could literally cut cinder blocks out of lava quite easily. And then use that resource that's, you know, flowing down and destroying one town, cut that stuff up and start building new homes out of it.
Interesting. See, I think ideas have to be tested, have to be out there. And I think it's not just going to be like one company. You know, I love this company out of Austin, Texas called Icon Build. They were on 60 Minutes a couple months ago, and I had them at the summit about two and a half years ago. And I like the fact that they are 3D printed homes that are temperature controlled, that are climate resilient, that can be made into models. They're designing some stuff for the Sioux Nation right now that's using traditional Lakota, you know, architecture. And they can do remote 3D printing. That's what they're working on right now because they got a contract to be the first 3D printed structure on the moon from NASA. So,
wow. And are they going to print it on the moon? Yeah. I guess so. Right. Wow.
Yeah, remotely. And, and they're such an exciting company, but they're not the only one. And they're one way forward. But these companies have to be nurtured. They have to be invested in. They have to be allowed to fail. Because if you're not allowed to fail, then you're not allowed to be brave. And we have to be brave moving into this next piece. We can't just sit around with climate doom and, you know, in our pajamas, like hoping for the best. We really have an opportunity to, you know, best our future, you know, to say, okay, all right, we've got this problem. We've done really hard things before. We've advanced when we needed to many times in this country and on this planet. Let's do this. Like, what an exciting opportunity. And also, we will mitigate and prevent so much pain and suffering, and we'll build equity into it so that people, you know, instead of like freaking out about their electric bill, what if they didn't have one?
Yeah, there you go.
You know? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, no, I think you might have just missed out on this, but when I was five, I remember being glued to the television set, you know, watching a man land on the moon, and that changed my life forever because it made me realize that anything is possible when you harness the human spirit and focus it towards a goal.
I love that. I missed out on that by a month.
Mega fires are no different.
They're no different. Thank you for that. That's exactly the kind of attitude and that we should be promoting and embracing. I was born, I think, a month later after that occurred. And I think that, and you know, that was an audacious goal. He gave us 10 years. I mean, we can do that. Like we build state-of-the-art weapons we do not use.
Oh, totally.
I mean,
right.
Come on. If we're doing that, like, why are we not, you know, people like this, people are all freaked out about AI. I get that. It's got some bad things, you know, the Taylor Swift thing, all that stuff is terrible. I understand, you know, that.
But if that's our biggest problem, you know, we could be able to get on with life.
We can. And I think that she would say the same too. But the idea of what we could do with AI for problem solving, for advancing engineering and science and systems as a tool is really, it boggles the mind how much that could make the acceleration of us as a, you know, how we live and how we're challenged, how we're dealing with these climate issues, while we're also trying to, you know, be more climate resilient, we can be more energy efficient, and then we can mitigate the effects of climate change and global warming and sea level rise. Like, we can do all of these things, but we really have to take our eye off of the stuff that distracts us. I'm not saying don't ever be distracted, but, you know, really look towards a more hopeful, innovative future. It's right there.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, why is it that we have truly innovative weaponry, right? Total Star Wars stuff. You can't even imagine the capabilities and the technological resources that it took to create these things. And the reality is that these things got created because there's a profit motive, right? Because the government said, we'll pay you to figure out how to use lasers to shoot drones out of the sky, or, you know, whatever it is that we need done. And, you know, there are times these things have to be done. I'm glad that these are funded and that they exist. But if we put the same type of, you know, institutional level funding towards solving wildfire problems, like, we would come up with solutions that would be every bit as effective at quelling fires as they are at, you know, quelling bad guys on international borders.
You know, right? You know, you're in the private sector space, so you understand too. Like, I think that the more that we invest, especially in that area, the more the government invests in that, and the more that we do allow for new models that maybe we hadn't thought of. When I was a teacher, one of the things I would tell my students is, you know, we have to prepare you for jobs that don't even exist yet. And we have to think about that in terms of, like, how do we actually tackle the challenges of climate change, but in a way that's actually kind of beautiful and interesting and joyful and doesn't have to be like, you know, it's too big. You know, we deal with stuff through taking one step at a time, through collaborating, through paying attention way across our silos to what people are doing, what they're thinking, what they're saying. And then look at, like, how do we invest this money? People don't mind. VC funders do not seem to mind much losing, you know, a few hundred million, few billion here and there on other ideas, like Twitter. So if we just took the money that Twitter lost this year, like $44 billion into all those private funds and invested it.
Push a button and the mega fire would go out.
It would be pretty much, well, solved. And, you know, we want it to be rare. We can't say that we can't control the earth, but we can say, what if it could be really rare? And what if we could actually put it out much sooner? And, you know, and what if we really invested in protecting our existing housing stock? You know, we have millions of homes in this country alone that are very vulnerable. And there are certain things that can be done. Even a $10,000 investment in your average home would make a huge difference. And a lot of people, if I may just high horse this one, who are in the space of who have the kind of VC dollars to push out into the world, sometimes they think, oh, you know, I'm going to work on that later, because even if I'm in LA and I'm in a high wildfire area, you know, a vulnerable area like Beverly Hills, because I just toured there, they think, I'll just rebuild my house, even if they will not insure me. What they don't understand is that often the most expensive houses are the slowest to rebuild. If you're in a community where 3,000, 1,000, 3,000, 6,000, in our case, almost 9,000 homes are burned down.
Wow.
Getting that custom home builder and all of the materials and the subs that you need is going to cost about 3 to 4 times, and it's going to, you know, what you are anticipating, probably way more than your insurance. And if you aren't insured, then a lot. And it's going to take years. You're not just going to like throw that back up, and your whole neighborhood is going to look that way. And so this isn't just this is an all of us problem. Florida yes. has like the third most vulnerable state to mega fires. Like this is not just a California issue. This is not just a, you know, Hawaii issue now. This is all of our issue.
It's Greece. It's Portugal. It's Australia. Yes. It's Brazil. Yeah. It's the whole world.
It is. It really is. And we also should cross sector. Like, I love working with Julie Shire Woodard from Smart Home America. She's a big proponent of fortified roofs, and she really is helping those be adopted throughout the southeast of the United States. Like, you know, but then there are places like Boulder, Colorado, where you should have both the systems from IBHS and Julie's work too. So there's a lot of crossover. And it is the future. And we're kind of letting China run away with the market of green building, green energy. Because you remember in the 70s.
Oh, the irony, huh?
I know.
Have you been to Beijing lately?
No, I haven't. But I've seen the air quality. Yeah.
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 Right. You can't breathe the air, but they're making sustainable goods for other markets.
Yeah. One of them being very ours. Weird. You know?
Yeah. No, of course.
Solar.
Yeah, well, I live in Boulder, and from my window, actually, you know, I looked out and I could see the Marshall Fire. I could actually see three distinct, you know, towns burning from my window. And boy, was I kicking myself that day that, you know, my suppression solution, you know, wasn't ready. But I got to shout out to the VC community a little bit, because when I had nothing more than a crayon sketch of technology, and I sent it to Tim Draper, and he sent us $500,000 and said, you know, go get started. Let me know how you do. We'll get around to some paperwork, but this is a critical problem and it needs a solution immediately. Good luck.
And that
type of response from people who, you know, who can help, you know, a lot of the spaces, a lot of the organizations in this space, you know, they are for-profit companies, but they operate like nonprofits because they're mission driven. Right. And if we had to choose between making money and, you know, saving lives, like we'd be saving lives.
That's so funny. So many people are like, you should just go into the private sector and you would make so much money as a consultant, because I know more about recovery than anybody else in the nation from a community perspective. And I'm like, oh yeah, I should do that. But then who would do my job? And so then I can't do it. Do you know?
Right.
I love that you were able to send a crayon drawing that he understood. And you should tell people on what date were you looking out of your window to see the Marshall.
Yeah, exactly. Basically New Year's Eve, right? And I hate that the fire happened. I love that it happened on New Year's Eve, because it finally debunked the idea of the fire season. It's like, wait a minute, there's not going to be a fire now. It's not between May and October. No, fires are, you know, any day of the year, any place in the world. And so
it doesn't care about your WUI. I mean, I appreciate WUI. You actually have one of the best wildfire planning people in the nation. Molly Mowry is right there in Boulder in Denver. She's just a genius. So I'm not saying that I don't love that work, but Megafire doesn't care about your WUI, though. When it's there, it will take, like what happened in Boulder and Superior and Louisville, is that it took a grassland fire, hot wind, December 30th, 2 points of ignition, one private homeowner that had a landowner who had a controlled burn, as you should be able to have on December 28th or something. Fire department goes out, checks it, signs off, no problem. But high winds blow all the topsoil off. And at the same time, an energy company had an arc. And then you have, all of a sudden, in 12 to 14 hours, you've lost 1,108 homes, grassland fire. And the homes were the ignition. And that is the area of investment that people should be thinking about. who have the ability to really change how it is that we are resilient to mega fires, because it's very possible.
Physically, the Marshall Fire was a forest fire where the houses were the trees.
Exactly. That's a very good description. I have not heard that before, but I'm probably going to steal it now.
Please. Steal generously.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, I'm so proud of the work that you're doing, and so encouraged that you're doing it, and that you've taken your experience and you've turned it into something that's really helping hundreds of thousands, and I'm sure eventually millions of people around the world. So thanks so much for giving up this hour to chat with us here on the Fire Break.
Steve, I really appreciate the work that you're doing as well. Like, keep pushing them in the private sector, keep pushing for your solutions. You know, this is how we get there, and we are only going to get there together on the other side to solve mega fire. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks so much, Jennifer. And folks, if you want to follow up on the work Jennifer's doing, she's not hard to find. You can find her on LinkedIn. You can find her at After the Fire. Is it afterthefire.com?
It's afterthefireusa.org.
Afterthefireusa.org. Mm-hmm. There we go. Super. So please look that up, and please send Jennifer a big check, because she's going to do something really good with it, and it may guarantee you a place in the afterlife. Who knows?
Right.
Anyway, thanks so much for joining me today on The Fire Break. I'm Steve Wolf. We're sponsored by Team Wildfire. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.